Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, there is a plant called wood sorrel that looks a little bit like clover when it's just a baby plant. But then it goes bad and develops seed pods that shoot out their seeds like little bullets. We'll tell you all about it and give you a side class on how plants can take their own food right out of the air after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Margaret, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, Margaret. How are you?
Well, I've had a cup of coffee, so now I'm awake.
I hear that. I spilled my first cup this morning. It was the greatest tragedy. It was the perfect cup of coffee. And I sat down at the table. I wasn't looking where I put it. I put it on a ridge, and it spilled all over the place.
Well, your mother will have to clean it up then, won't she?
Yeah, good luck with that. Where did Margaret enjoy her coffee instead of spilling it?
I'm in Enid, Oklahoma.
Enid?
North Central Oklahoma.
All right, what can we do for Margaret in Oklahoma?
Well, I was looking through a catalog recently on tulips. And when I became a master gardener in Arkansas, they said, well, we just generally think of tulips as being an annual. And I thought, well, that's an awful lot of work to go through every year planting a lot of tulips. And then I happened across some information on your website that said if you don't overwater and overfeed them and plant things on top of them, tulips actually will do well. So I was thinking about planting tulips in a place where they would not be stepped on and they would not be covered over with other flowers. I have a small brick walkway that only myself and the little dogs walk on. And I thought, well, if I planted tulips down, I took some bricks out and planted some tulips here and there, they could come up every year and they would be safe from the other activity in the garden. And I was just wondering if that is possible.
Yes, that sounds like a marvelous plan. And I think one of the reasons they may have said what they said in Arkansas is that's a much warmer winter climate than...
Yes, it is. It's actually almost tropical in some places.
Exactly.
I had roses in Arkansas that would bloom all winter.
Exactly right. But some plants... specifically fruit trees like peaches and apples, native fruits like blueberries, and all of the spring bulbs have what's called a chilling requirement, a certain hundred number of hours where the temperature drops below, I believe it's 40 or 45 degrees. It doesn't have to freeze, but you have to get hundreds of hours of cold weather. So in Arkansas, what they were doing is they were buying what are called pre-chilled bulbs, bulbs that had been put in a big professional fridge, chilled for 12 to 14 weeks. And then they could possibly have not naturalized them, but used them again if they dug them up and potted them up and chilled them like they were forcing them. But that's too much work for anybody. So you can grow spring bulbs like that down in warmer climates, but your friends were absolutely correct. You tend to be using bulbs that have been specially prepared, and you don't expect to see them again. I will tell you that the most reliable tulips to come back year after year are just the big red ones.
Big red ones, okay.
The big red ones, or I would even say species tulips, which are the smaller, more natural tulips, the ones that are actually very much like the ones that were originally found in the mountains of Turkey and Afghanistan.
Right, okay.
The least reliable would be the Darwins and the parrots, you know, the really fancy ones. I have some in my own flower bed out front that have reliably returned for at least a decade. And especially where you are, no offense, your climate is a lot like Afghanistan. You get very cold winters.
Yes.
And then you have blazingly hot and dry summers.
Oh, yeah.
That's in the DNA of tulips. That's their secret origin story. That's why they're only above ground for that short period of time. They go underground to escape the summer searing heat. They're dry all summer long. They go dormant. And then in the winter, it snows. They're still dormant. But then when that snow melts, that waters them. The warm ground wakes them up. So they bloom.
That's right.
And then the only thing you have to do to make sure they come back is not cut their greenery off.
Right, I have heard that.
As soon as it starts to lose its green color, then you can clip those leaves off. But as long as they're bright green, let them go, and that'll recharge the bulb from year to year. But no, your climate is perfect for growing tulips.
I'd hate to go to all the trouble to order and buy beautiful tulip bulbs and plant them and plant them and plant them and then have them die.
But again, if you want to see them for decades and decades and decades, get the most basic types, either the big red ones or the species types.
Okay, great. Thanks for your help.
All right, Margaret, good luck.
All right, thank you very much, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Jeff. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks.
And where is Jeff good?
I am in Irwin, Pennsylvania.
And where is Irwin?
About 40 miles east of Pittsburgh.
40?
Well, let's go 30.
Okay. Are you out in Frank Lloyd Wright territory? Are you anywhere near Falling Water?
Not that far, about an hour away.
All right. What can we do for Jeff from the left coast of Pennsylvania?
I have an issue that started years ago, and I've decided I need help. I had my great-grandfather's Concord grapevine,
which
was started by my grandfather. Unfortunately, it would get to the point where the grapes were gorgeous, and then they would just dry up and shrivel. And somebody told me that it was black rot or black spot or something.
You were right the first time.
Okay, and there's no way to get rid of it except to cut it down, clean up the area, and let it regrow. Go ahead.
That's kind of correct, but if phrased improperly, that's not how you, quote, get rid of it. That's simply how you take care of grapes.
Oh, okay. That works. So eventually, because it was built over a deck, I decided I could never get it all cleaned up. So I cut it down and we let it go and we no longer have it.
Oh.
However, unfortunately, but it seems like it's spread to other parts of the garden. I lost a whole bank of roses to what seemed like the same thing. And then I had a peach tree that did the same thing. The fruit came all the way on, and then it would like just shrivel up and die. And so the peach tree's gone, the roses are gone, and now I have blackberries. And the blackberries last year were the size of 50-cent pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And this year I had the same thing, but I had a section of them with the berries on the vine completely shrivel up and turn brown.
Okay.
Is this the same thing?
No, but there's a common thread here. Okay. But in all of these things, the peaches and the grapes specifically, did you ever care for them? Did you practice a yearly ritual of pruning and thinning and cleaning up the floor after the season was over?
Yeah, probably not as much as I should have. I mean, the pruning part I did, but not so much the floor.
Yeah, that's where the disease incubates, on the orchard floor. That's what the first rule of growing peaches, apples, or grapes is: you clean up all the dead fruit and the mummies at the end of the season, so you start off with a clean plate. And then both grapes should be pruned in the dead of winter. Peaches should be pruned when they first begin flowering. Now, your roses, that sounds to me like wood mulch. Do you have wood mulch underneath these roses?
I did, yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's that. You were accidentally incubating disease all over your property.
Perfect.
Now, is the mulch gone now?
It is now, yeah.
Okay. Have you replaced it with anything?
I did not have to, really, because it just sort of, it disintegrated into, like, dirt, more or less.
Okay. And are the roses still alive, even though they look like Hades?
The gigantic peace rose, which was almost 4 inches around at the base, is completely gone.
Oh.
But I have other roses that are doing well.
Okay. So here's the short course on roses. Normally, I would say don't prune anything. But if you have heavily diseased areas, like it's oozing black, prune those off
right
now. clean up underneath them whether you think you need to or not. And then just leave them alone over winter. In the spring, as soon as you see new growth appear on the roses, wait 2 weeks and then go out and prune away any of the diseased areas from last year, any branches that are crowded or crossing. And I want you to have a good supply of yard waste compost. That's compost made from like fall leaves.
Sure.
Not composted manure, no more wood mulch. And was there wood mulch underneath the blackberries too?
Exactly.
Yeah, get rid of all that trash. All it's doing is incubating every bad fungal spore in the neighborhood. If you simply replace all that old wood mulch you used to use, get a whole truckload delivered of black yard waste compost, use it to mulch your landscape, your plants will come back strong and healthy.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for all the help.
All right. Good luck, Jeff.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Spring City Library just outside of Royers Ford, PA on Friday evening, September 30th, and at the Huntington Valley Library on Sunday afternoon, October 23rd. I must be cultured. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with exploding flowers, nitrogen fixation, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, yes, clovers and some other plants can fix nitrogen. They can feed themselves by taking their own food right out of the air. Ah, but there are some weeds that look a little bit like clover that can't do that and that don't have much going for them. At the end of the show, we'll tell you more about nitrogen fixation and what to do if your clover is actually wood sorrel. That's a lot to do. We better hop right to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it, Ron. This is Ron Ryle from Pottstown, right?
Yes, Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
Very good. You are a well-known butterfly enthusiast who, despite not having much land at all, you put out a lot of butterfly plants and you do an annual butterfly count at your home, right?
Yes, yes.
And we'll ask you what kind of a year it's been, but you just sent out an email a day or two ago in which you describe being witness to kind of a fascinating part of the progress that I don't think we get to see that often, correct?
Yes. As far as I know, I don't know of anyone who's ever seen a monarch lay approximately 100 eggs one after another. It happened on September 5th, and the monarchs began migrating around September 1st. So this female stayed around, and these monarchs aren't going to make it down to Mexico. They're not going to leave here from Potsdam until approximately October 5th.
So how should it work in a world pre-climate change? Would this monarch have been laying her eggs much earlier in the summer?
I would say a little bit earlier. It's not completely uncommon, but for that many eggs, it definitely is.
So
you know, one or two eggs here and there, maybe later. There's still a monarch migration in October, but to think that this monarch laid that many eggs in September, it was incredible.
Because Mama's not going to go anywhere, right? Mama's done.
She's all done. She'll spend the rest of her life in Pennsylvania.
That's what she gets. Second prize. So I guess I misunderstood the process from egg to caterpillar to adult. It must be very fast in the monarch.
Well, it's about 30 days. So you figure September 5th to October 5th.
Now, what do the eggs look like?
They're white, and 99% of the time they're on the bottom of the milkweed leaf. And they're the size of a pencil point or a pen point. They're very small.
Now, will those eggs grow in size, or will they just release a tiny caterpillar?
They release a tiny caterpillar within 4 days. It's just like clockwork, Mike. The first egg I saw, I was keeping track of three different leaves. It was born midday on Saturday. Now, the only way I know is I saw a hole in the milkweed leaf. The caterpillar is invisible the first 2 days unless you use a magnifying glass.
So it's that tiny, and you say it came out 4 or 5 days after its egg was laid.
Exactly 4 days. It happens just about every single time, 4 days.
Now, did you go out there with a hand lens and get a good look at this little bugger?
I did not. I just waited till actually, I just brought him inside today.
And
that caterpillar.
And how big is he now?
He's only about a quarter of an inch.
Oh, okay. Now, the caterpillar, the monarch caterpillars, like the butterfly, have a very unique coloration. They're very colorful, theoretically, to ward off predators, telling the predators they've taken some of the noxious chemicals out of the milkweed plant. Do these little babies have any sign of that coloring yet?
They do. They're green, yellow, and black.
Because I would think at this stage they're the most delicate of prey, so to speak.
Yeah, birds do eat them. They're only slightly toxic. It's a misconception that the monarch caterpillar is poisonous to birds. That is not true.
But
many of the books were written years ago still have, you can still read that in those books, and that's definitely not true.
But that's what the caterpillar wants you to believe.
Yeah, but see, the milkweed, the milk is slightly toxic, but it will not kill a bird.
So now you say you brought this creature inside. Do you have an indoor milkweed garden? Are you bringing it like fresh milkweed plants, like hay to dairy cow or something?
Yeah, that's the idea, the hay to the dairy cow. I'm bringing milkweed leaves to it now. I'll be doing that. Well, I filled the container. I was using jars. I decided since I had so many eggs that I probably would need to buy, it's a sterilite container, something you store clothes in. They don't have to have air. They're hermetic, so they don't need oxygen. So on a jar, you don't have to punch holes in the lid. And the same with the container I just bought. I just snap the lid on and keep all the predators out, and they do fine.
So you'll watch them, and they'll grow to full size.
Yes, and then they'll make a chrysalis on the top, on the lid. Most of the other butterflies require a stick to make a chrysalis. The monarch does not.
You say the eggs hatch like in exactly 4 days, like clockwork.
It's incredible. It's always 4 days. I've never had one not do that.
And so do you have any idea how long it will take for this chrysalis stage to release its butterfly?
The chrysalis stage is about a week.
And will you be opening the lid, checking on them every day? Will you just come in one day and see a butterfly flopping around in there?
No, you have to clean your container out, the cage I call it. You have to clean your container on every day because they go to the bathroom left and right. You have to make sure you don't get bacteria in there.
And then when they're ready to come out, will you take the whole schmageggy outside? Will you have a house full of monarchs that are confused watching daytime television?
Well, what will actually happen, they'll hang on the chrysalis they just come out of. The chrysalis, of course, it's a jade green with a gold trim. It's a very incredible, beautiful chrysalis. And it turns black. You can see the monarch right the day before it comes out. You can see the orange butterfly in there. And then it hangs on the chrysalis for 2 hours to dry. It drops fluid. You have to have a napkin on the bottom of your container to catch the fluid. You don't want to get the wings more wet than they already are. It takes 2 hours for the wings to dry, actually.
Right.
Then the monarch is ready for flight.
And, again, will they be outside at this point?
I'll be taking them outside and watching them go southwest.
Now, they have fed voraciously on the milkweed leaves, the baby caterpillars. They have been feeding during this not a really long period of time, to my mind. And then they go through metamorphosis, and then they get released, and they will fly from Pottstown to Mexico?
Yes, they sure will. Actually, they found one of mine that left here September 20th of 2003, recovered March 21st of 2004 in El Rosario, Mexico.
And how long will it take them to get there, Ron? The ones you release, let's say October 1st, for lack of a better date. How long does it take to fly to Mexico?
The scientists are saying, and Monarch Watch at the University of Kansas does most of the research, they're estimating 28 days, but no one's really positive at this point.
Right, and you fly to Mexico, for sure they're going to lose your luggage, so there's a couple of extra days in there.
So, and
will you be tagging each of these individual creatures?
Well, I've already tagged 35. I tagged some each day this month. Two were born this morning. I tagged them. So I'll tag as many as I can. I only have 50 tags.
And what is a tag like? I mean, we're talking a butterfly here.
Yeah, it goes on the back wing. The monarch is it's designed with a skeletal cells, black lines, and they're very strong, actually. And there's one larger cell on the back wing where you place the tag. It's a sticker made by the 3M company. It's very, very sticky.
You're putting a sticky note on the back of these things.
Exactly. and it sticks. The thing of it is, I tagged one female on September 12th, and would you believe she's still here? She's the only one that didn't leave. Now, what's going to happen there? Is she going to mate?
I don't know, but the adults do take some pollen and nectar to energize them, right?
They really don't need it. They do take some. They take nectar as all. They have a straw. The proboscis is the straw that they drink the nectar, but they actually are born with enough in their body, enough fluid to make the trip to Mexico. And right now they're staying, today they went down to 2 minutes. Yesterday the monarchs were staying 7 minutes, taking monarch on Mexican sunflower. Today it's down to 2 minutes. Eventually it's going to be down to 90 seconds.
Because they know they're running out of time. They got to get out of the area before it gets cold.
Yeah, what they do is, so far what we believe is, when the days become shorter, they sense that. When there's less daylight, that's when they head for Mexico.
Right, and you just mentioned something that I want to close with. You grow all different kinds of milkweed to feed the caterpillars, but you grow a flower called tithonia, Mexican sunflower. That's the best source of food for the adults.
It is. If you want to see the migration at your home, if you grow Mexican sunflower, the monarchs will stop at your house on the way to Mexico. I'm expecting, we've been having about 30 to 50 a day so far. I'm expecting this to go as high as 200 a day next week. This is a very, very good monarch season in Pennsylvania.
Excellent. Ron Ryle in Pottstown, a friend to all kinds of butterflies, but a special friend to monarchs. Ron, thanks very much for sharing your great experience with us.
Thanks, Mike, for having me. Have a great day.
You too, sir.
All right, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Kristen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Kristen. How are you?
I'm good.
And where is Kristen Good?
Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia.
Outside of Philadelphia. What part? Come on.
Downingtown.
Oh, west of I know Downingtown. Yeah, no, that's a nice little area out there.
Yeah.
All right, what can we do for Kristen in Downingtown?
We started a compost pile this year and created all our own compost from the organic scraps from the table and scraps from the cutting the grass and things. So we went to use it, and we put these tomato plants out, and we mixed the compost with some topsoil. And the tomato plants, they bared fruit, but not as many as we had the year prior. And they kind of burnt out. They were like brown, almost like they were dying at the same time that they were producing the fruit. It was very odd looking. And we were just wondering if we did something wrong with our compost.
When did you start the compost? When did you put the first item into?
Oh, so that was probably maybe a year that.
Okay. So last fall.
Built the box. Yeah.
And
or
it's
less.
It's an outdoor box.
Yes.
With room for airflow.
Yes, there is room for airflow.
And what's the box made of?
Well, it's a wood structure, and then there's like wire meshing.
That sounds good. That sounds good. What kind of wood?
Maybe pine.
But you're pretty sure it wasn't pressure treated wood. It didn't have the little tags on the end?
No, it wasn't pressure treated.
Okay. And did you put in a lot of shredded fall leaves?
I don't know, like the mix. It was sort of, I'm thinking that we got it going after the fall cleanup. So it might have been less than a year. It could have been closer to 6 months.
Okay, because as I shouldn't have to tell you, if you just throw a lot of garbage in a big pile outside, it starts to look pretty nasty after a while.
Yeah, no, it didn't look like that. It actually looked like compost. I mean, it was being turned.
So, yeah, but I mean, if you're just turning eggshells and lettuce leaves, or unless there's something in there you're not telling me about.
No, but it could have been heavier on scraps than the actual grass trimmings, because I don't know when we did the fall cleanup, but it might not have been built.
Well, first of all, you're always supposed to leave your clippings behind on the lawn. If you leave your clippings behind, that supplies half the food lawns need in any given season, because those clippings are pure nitrogen and water, which are the only two things your lawn needs. You know, my experience has been from back before I knew what to do, that when I tried to compost fresh grass clippings, it just turned into a slimy black mass.
It was kind of slimy. I would say that's part of it. It was definitely black and slimy. I know every time we cut the grass, we were bagging it and putting it in there.
Oh, okay. So, well, but you say you don't feed your grass.
Uh-uh.
Okay. Because now you're going to have two problems. You're going to have your lawn is going to start dying out, because grass is a heavy feeder. And one of the ways we can feed it is to use a dedicated mulching mower that always returns the clippings back to the lawn. But one of the dirty little secrets of composting is you don't need grass clippings in a compost pile. A compost pile consists of basic two things. Your dry brown materials, which are your shredded fall leaves, they supply the carbon that actually becomes the bulk of the finished compost. Your kitchen scraps and maybe one set of clippings from your lawn, if you really feel you must, they provide the nitrogen that actually feeds the microbes that turn the shredded fall leaves into compost. So you didn't really have compost. You had a very nitrogen-rich slurry that probably did, you even use the words, burned your plants.
Yeah, it's kind of what it looked like.
Yeah, well, that's what happens. Were you to have used a high nitrogen chemical fertilizer on tomatoes, if you were to use a hot horse manure or a chicken manure, same thing would happen. All that nitrogen would burn your plants. But I think the good news is now that you know, I mean, your timing could not be more perfect. What you want to do is either use your lawnmower to shred up as many fall leaves as you can collect, or get a leaf blower that has a reverse setting where you can suck them up and shred them. And that's what you fill your bin with. And then, yeah, sure, you can mix your kitchen waste in there with it. But if you're not going to shred up your fall leaves, then forget the outdoor pile and get a worm bin indoors that will process your kitchen waste, because I guarantee you worm castings will never harm a plant. Gardens Alive is one supplier you might be able to find at other places. There's a device called the Worm Tower, and these are stackable trays. They're like a foot square. You fill a tray, which is porous on the bottom. You fill it with all the kitchen waste you can. You cover that with some shredded newspaper, and then you put in your starter worms. And then you have other trays, and as you get more garbage together, you put the new trays on top. And by the time you use up, say, your fourth tray, you're out of trays now, the bottom tray will be finished compost. The worms move up. They move up to the fresh garbage. If you're not going to be working a lot of fall leaves, that's the best way to compost your kitchen waste. You just can't leave the worms outdoors over the winter. They would freeze.
Okay.
So they need, they need to be under the sink or in a garage or something. I would go back to leaving your clippings on the lawn, get a worm bin for indoors, you know, what few leaves you have, shred them up and throw them in there. In a couple of years, you'll be surprised at what it gives you.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, good luck, Kristen.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Fredericksburg, Virginia Home and Garden Show on Saturday and Sunday, October 15th and 16th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with exploding flowers, nitrogen fixation, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. A listener thought she had clover growing in her flower beds, and she knows that clover can fix nitrogen and feed plants. Well, turns out she has wood sorrel, so we're going to help her get rid of that. And she slightly misunderstands the science of nitrogen fixation, so we'll take a little side dip into how some plants really can pull their own food out of the air. In the meantime, it's time for me to pull another one of your phone calls out of the air at 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am just ducky. Thanks for asking. Where is Chris Good?
We are good in Wilmington, Delaware.
Excellent. What can we do for Chris in Wilmington?
I have two dogwood trees that are on either side of my driveway, and they were there when I bought the house like 8 years ago. and they are slowly looking sadder and sadder each season. More dead limbs are kind of outgrowing the actual leaves that come out in the spring, and there seems to be like a green algae on the, or I'm assuming it's algae, on the dead limbs. But the dead limbs, like further up in the tree, like they stick out as dead, but they also do have shoots of, you know, live leaves coming off of them. And I'm not sure if I should get someone to come in and prune them, if I can do them myself, when should I do it? So I figured I'd call and ask.
Okay, so dogwoods do best when they get morning sun and afternoon shade. What kind of sun exposure do these plants get?
It's the complete opposite.
Okay, so that's one stress on them. What time do they start getting their sun?
Like noon is when it really hits, because then the tree that normally is blocking them from the morning sun, the sun's high enough over that.
Okay. And are they growing out of a lawn?
Yep, lawn, no mulch around it. It's just grass that goes right up to the trunks.
Is the grass treated with anything?
Nope, don't treat it with anything.
What do you feed it?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Just grass clippings.
So you return your clippings to the lawn.
Yeah.
And you say there's no mulch. You say they were healthy looking when you moved in?
From what I remember. It's only been recently that I've realized they look so good.
Yeah. Do you think they're getting less sun now as the other plantings have grown over the years?
No. The tree that is on my neighbor's side that blocks the morning sun from coming in has been there for as long as we have been, and it's huge. It's not like it's, you know, a new tree that just started.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And it doesn't have any dead areas that need pruning or anything like that?
No. No.
So what I want you to do is no pruning now, but okay. I want you to hoe away the grass from the trunks of the trees as much as you can. Just get a sharp hoe and just kind of pull the sod away as much as you can. And then I want you to make a circle of compost around both trees,
okay,
about 1 to 2 inches thick, and going out in a nice circle as far as the furthest branches reach out. And that's yard waste compost, not composted manure.
Okay. Worm castings work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they would cost you quite a bit to get that many.
Okay. I can start it at least with that.
Right. It's just, that would be nice to feed the trees with, to actually seed some of that into the compost.
Okay, great.
And then in the spring, when the tree leafs out again, then, yes, you can go to town, remove any dead branches, and then open it up to get better airflow in there. It's probably suffering from staying wet in the morning. So open the trees up for better airflow, get rid of the dead limbs this spring, and I think the combination of that and spreading the compost, keep the grass away from the margins of the tree as best you can, and give them a nice mulch of compost every year, they may surprise you.
All right, great. Thank you.
All right. It's the oldest rule. When you can't give a plant enough sun, you give it everything else you can.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Chris.
Thank you.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Patty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Patty. Thank you so much
good.
For asking. How are you?
Wonderful. I love this low humidity. It's delightful.
And where is Patty enjoying some low humidity?
In Ballykinwood.
Just outside of Philadelphia?
Yes.
All right. What can we do for Patty in Ballykinwood?
We have an ailing serviceberry. It seemed to be that after a ton of rain a few months ago, it went crazy with aphids. The titmice and the chickadees ate them every day nicely. But the tree diminished. The aphids were gone. The leaves are yellowy orange and very sparse. I'm worried about it. We felt maybe it was too much water. Now I don't know if it needs water because we've had such a drought. So some of the tips are brown, of the branches are brown and brittle. Others are growing. Don't know what she needs.
Okay. So how long has the tree been in the ground?
4 or 5 years, I think.
Okay.
And bore fruit, you know, did well.
Okay. And you planted it?
Yes.
When you planted it, did you remove all the wrappings, the burlap, the wire cage?
Yes.
Okay, good,
yes.
Good. Is it planted in or near a lawn?
We have no lawn. It's a certified wild garden.
Oh, that's great. Oh, and what a tragedy then, because the serviceberry is like the
I
ultimate.
Know. Of course, we have elderberries growing. We got every kind of berry you can imagine for the birds.
That's fabulous. Well, service berries are considered to be like the one of the best plants for wildlife. And I don't know, did you enjoy any of the berries when they appeared?
No, we have blueberries too. We never get one. We have grapes growing in arbors. Nothing. We get nothing because the birds clear them out at 5 in the morning.
Yes, yes. Birds are famous for blueberries. Okay, so has the plant been fed?
No, never.
And is it mulched with anything?
No.
Is there any kind of a watering system, irrigation system in your garden?
No. We just water what we have, or we just let the rain take over. But I've been watering a little bit more now because there's no water and everything looks terrible.
Right. And when you water, how do you water?
Mostly with a couple of watering cans, or if the hose reaches, let it drip down.
Is everything very crowded there? I know Ballachinwood. The landscapes tend to be small.
Well, yes, it's small, but we do have a very crowded garden, but nothing is really around the service berry. There's some vinca that we fight with all the time to pull up around. We haven't totally cleared all that out, and it's near the elderberries, but really it has air and space all around.
Okay, so it's
There's no grass.
It's not overly crowded. You know, although service berries are traditionally not pruned, if it does get crowded in the center, aphids are a sign of a crowded plant, you know, or an overfed plant, but you're not feeding yours. That would be my suggestion, however, without being able to look at it. Well, I would say look around and be honest and maybe do some pruning in the spring after things start growing again. In the meantime, I want you to change your watering system. I want you to either set up a sprinkler that you can aim at all of these plants and only run it in the morning. But I also want you to keep a calendar. Every time it rains, just put a couple of buckets out or something like that, or get a rain gauge.
Okay.
So when you go a week without rain, especially if we're going through these hot spells, because we had many heat waves this summer.
Yes.
If you go a week without rain, I want you to turn that sprinkler on first thing in the morning and let it hit all of the plants and let it run for hours and hours and hours. Let it really saturate the ground. But then don't run it again for another week. And that's, again, only if we don't get rain. 1 inch of week applied in one big dumping. First thing in the morning. Don't ever do that at night. And if the aphids show up again, I want you to get right up close to the tree with a nozzle that can apply high water pressure.
Yeah.
And you just blast them out of the tree.
Okay.
You just not a gentle mist, not watering the leaves. I want it to look like a hurricane. I want to see those leaves moving along. I want to see you blast off a couple. That is the most successful way to get rid of aphids.
I see. Now, the thing is, do you think because it doesn't have enough water that there's sparse leaves, there's not too many leaves? It has growing tips, but not too many leaves.
You might.
And then they yellow.
You might actually want to feed your plants in your landscape by having a big load of compost delivered and give a couple of shovelfuls of compost and give everything, give everything a good feeding. You know, a lot of plants have been stressed. This has been the warmest winter and warmest summer in history. So it's not surprising that even sturdy plants like this are under stress. So I want you to pay attention to your watering and give them a good feeding with compost.
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right.
Thanks for your help.
My pleasure. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling the Great Imposter, when wood sorrel looks like clover. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this sad tale of woody woe.
All right, here we go. Carol, who lives in Pensbury Township in southern Chester County, near Kennett Square, PA, writes, I have had a clover-looking growth invading my vegetable garden for a very long time. I thought it was clover, but now suspect it is wood sorrel, oxalis. I hadn't been vigorously weeding it out because I thought it was clover and its root nodules were fixing nitrogen and enriching my soil. Does wood sorrel provide any soil enhancement?
Ha! She wishes. Actually, the non-smarty pants answer is that this and other weeds can enrich the soil. If they're pulled out of the ground while they're still young, before they can flower, with lots of soil attached to their roots and added to a compost pile. You know, some weeds are especially good at improving finished compost, like dandelions, whose roots contain a lot of calcium.
But I'm guessing that this weed isn't one of the especially good ones. Now, why did you specify keeping lots of soil attached to the roots when you compost them?
Well, the basic green plant is going to be a very good source of nitrogen for the pile, which is especially important if that pile is, as we urge every year at this time, composed of lots of fall leaves that you've collected and shredded. Those shredded leaves are the dry, brown, carbon-rich component that actually becomes the bulk of the finished compost. The fresh, wet, green, nitrogen-rich young plants essentially provide food for the process. And the soil attached to those roots is teeming with microbial life that'll help get the carbon and nitrogen dancing faster. One of the oldest bits of composting advice is to add handfuls of finished compost or good soil to the ingredients as you build your pile to really get things cooking.
And if these plants were clovers and not wood sorrel, they'd be the best weeds to add, right? Because of that nitrogen-fixing thing.
Yes, clovers and other legumes have the potential to form a symbiotic relationship with organisms in the soil that allow the plants to actually use some of the nitrogen in the air we breathe as plant food, fixing the nitrogen in their actual cells. But most gardeners, including Carol, misunderstand the process. Growing nitrogen-fixing plants doesn't automatically increase the fertility of your soil.
Uh-oh. Sounds like it's time for Dr. Science to make an appearance.
Yeah, just let me slip into my white lab coat here. Okay. As we said, certain plants can at least partially feed themselves using atmospheric nitrogen,
which makes up the vast majority of the air we breathe.
A lusty 78%. But most plants can't access this rich food. And even the ones that can need the help of specific groups of bacteria that live in the soil. When the roots of the right kinds of plants, like clover, peas, and string beans, encounter the right bacteria, the plant can use some of the nitrogen in the air to feed itself, but not to feed the soil. To enrich the soil, you have to then till those plants under at the end of the season, a technique that organic farmers call green manuring, or compost the nitrogen-rich plants.
So the nitrogen is bound up inside the plants while they're actively growing.
Exactly right. Now, to get back to Carol's sorrel sorrow, in the great reference book, The Weeds of North America, from the University of Chicago Press, the authors agree that, quote, when not in flower, wood sorrel is often confused with white clover.
But in flower?
Nothing like it. Nothing at all. Wood sorrel has traditionally shaped bright yellow flowers, which turn into crazy bad seed pods that look like miniature okra. And then they explode.
Explode?
Violently. The University of Chicago weed book says that the abundant seeds can travel up to 2 meters, that's 6 feet. In one of my absolute favorite reference books, Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast, Harvard's Peter Del Tredici calls it 10 feet.
Either way, this is a plant you don't want to let go to seed.
Right, and there's no loss in pulling it early in the season because the flowers aren't even pollinated by insects.
So it's not bringing bees and other pollinators into the garden. Does it have any uses?
Well, it has a weird and long history of the leaves being eaten in small amounts by children for their sour taste, which an 1859 report called agreeable acidity.
Is it safe to eat?
In small amounts, yeah. But as its scientific name, oxalis, suggests, it is high in oxalic acid, which can make you feel sick if you eat too much.
Okay, so your advice is pull and compost?
and try really hard to prevent any more of those explosive seed heads from forming. It sounds like she could have a lot of it by now, so she needs to go slow. Pull out all of the young plants in one bed or a designated area every season and have a flame weeder on hand to torch the distinctive yellow flowers as soon as they appear on the rest of the plants, because only you can prevent explosive seed pods. Well, that sure was some interesting information about clover, nitrogen, and exploding seed pods, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with links to lots of other articles about clover, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to plant sorrel in my strawberries if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And please be sure to include your location, especially if you are certain that we do not need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, and where you will probably find the answers to all of those garden questions you were going to email us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY and directed today's show. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website all fixed up. Our new intern is Alicia Lester. And one of our previous interns, Stephen Dre Hobol, came in today to help out while the hardest working woman in show business, Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY in Philadelphia, attends a public broadcasting event in D.C. Our editor is still the same old Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and you know, I never get invited to those things. Well, maybe that's because of the unfortunate incident with the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me crowd at the last public radio conference I attended. Now, it's Peter Sagal's fault. He started it. I still don't think you can call what happened a rumble. There weren't nearly enough of us involved. Oh, well, all that means that I'll still be here to see you again next week. Okay, so maybe I was wearing a black leather jacket. Does that count for that much? What do you get when you cross a dirt doctor with a pruning expert? A fruiting pear. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll celebrate our show's 18th anniversary with Dr. Lee Reich and Howard Garrett, and they'll take your fabulous phone calls.